Joining me on the Catalyst hotline is David Brancaccio, who is the host and senior editor of the Marketplace Morning Report on PBS. Welcome, sir.
Hey, glad to be here.
So you're going to be in town this week to actually have two appearances, one with Poynter and then one at the Palladium with the Open. You're coming in as an arrestee speaker. And the idea is we'll preview a little bit about what you're going to talk about and then dig into it. So what will be your topics?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to cover a bunch of stuff. One of the events has a sustainability theme. It's one of the beats that we have on the Marketplace Morning Report. You think of like a business show, which is what we are. It's going to be covering the stock market and, you know, profits and losses and quarterlies and stuff like that. We do, but we also go deeper. And one of the key themes that we have is, you know, sustainability as a beat. And so I'll be going through some of our coverage and actually engaging with the audience on some of the themes there. But among the things I'm going to talk about on the other night is something that I've spent a lot of time working on. We did a radio documentary and then a series for my show, multi-part series called Brains and Losses. Brains and Losses. It's about the effect of aging on financial vulnerability, about exploitation and scammers and stuff. And turns out this was really interesting new medical research that sheds light on this stuff.
Interesting. So I'm assuming that that research will say that the older that one gets, the more potentially vulnerable they are to being scammed.
Yeah. I mean, Joe, we know, right, that if someone is suffering from a dementia or some kind of cognitive decline, they're going to be vulnerable to financial exploitation. Mm-hmm. And that could be, you know, some weirdo on the phone trying to pick your pocket. It could be a criminal family member, right, trying to fleece someone who's related to them.
Right.
But what is also interesting from the research we're doing is in the normally aging, healthy brain, not everybody, but some people, they're seeing actual changes to the brain that points to some people becoming more vulnerable. It's almost like our radar for scams may decline some as we get a little bit older. Now, the good news here is that as we get older, we also get wisdom, right? Wisdom is, among other things, life experience. We've seen a lot of this world by the time we're older. That helps counteract some of this. So, you know, you've been around the world enough to know where to look for scammers. At the same time that parts of the brain might be changing, that hurts your ability to detect it. And here's what we're talking about. They did a study, for instance, in which they showed young and old drawings of faces of people that were benign, sort of vaguely friendly. And then they showed young and old faces of people who were slightly menacing. I mean, if it was super menacing, that would be a giveaway. And older people in general had a harder time detecting the more menacing faces. It's pretty striking, right? The other thing is some people may find it tougher to say no to a high-pressure sales tactic. Interesting counterintuitive stuff that's come up with research is that, you know, you think, well, you get a little bit older, you've seen a lot of the world, that you'd be risk-averse, that you've been stung so many times by earlier bad decisions that we all make, that you'd be a little bit careful as you get older. Well, some people are, but some people actually take more risk as they get older. There's this kind of tendency to go, yeah, I'll give that a try. What's the worst that could happen that can creep in? Now, I need to emphasize, this is really important, it's not everybody. And if you think about it, like billionaire Warren Buffett, he's an older gentleman. Mm-hmm. He's going to be cleverer about money than you and I will ever be, okay? For sure. It's not everybody. But it's something that we have to watch because the amount of money being fleeced off of people by a scammer that they meet in the street,
right,
or someone calling from many countries away, or indeed somebody's niece or nephew, it's just such a fortune of money. And once the money is gone, unfortunately, very low chances of recovering this. So what the scientists are trying to do is there some way, and they haven't really come up with foolproof ways yet, is there some way through interviews, questions asked, or by scanning the brain that they can see who might be more vulnerable than others to scammers calling? And I talked to this researcher. He's done work up at Cornell University in New York State and also McGill University in Montreal. They found a group of older people who had, there had been a scam attempt but they spotted the scam. Okay, they had that group. Mm-hmm. You know, they detected the scam before it happened. They're like, this is not on the up and up. I can tell I'm being scammed, and they didn't get scammed. They found an equivalent group in demographics, similar age, gender, that type of thing, income, similar group that had been scammed, and they looked at their brains, and they did notice a difference that they're researching further. It's around the part of the brain that these scientists tell me has to do with your kind of sixth sense, your kind of hunch. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like if you go down, like they tell you, if you're parking on the wrong side of town and you get that instinct, hey, this isn't right, that you're supposed to act on that. You're supposed to go, yeah, hey, wait a minute. Maybe I shouldn't be here. It's possible that that part of the brain changes a little bit as we get older. So we need to build in protections to safeguard some of the stuff.
You know, I would say that you get out of the car on the wrong side of town, that the things that that give you that feeling are the sum of your inputs. Obviously, there's nothing inherently bad about a part of town. It's clues that you compare against previous frameworks. And most of the scams that I hear about are typically involve technology in some way or another. You know, a lot of people are using TeamViewer to, you know, and they act like bank representatives and whatnot. So I wonder, do you think a lot of that is the speed at which technology has come up upon them, you know, beyond their sort of brain formative years, such that they have to have a higher degree of trust in, because so much technology they don't understand?
It's a really good question. I'm glad you raised that. There is a theory about exactly that, which is some people who've grown up with, say, the web and with digital devices, you know, the digital natives, might they have more experience than some older people with the technology, and therefore they're more open to scams. I did find this, though, that people of all ages get scammed. It just depends on the scam. And what we're worried about is older people in particular, because they lose the most money. They lose the most money partly because they have the most money, right? People have saved, but also they don't have as much time as a younger person has to make it back. You know, it might mean if they lose their life savings that they're stuck in some really bad situation when they're in their 80s or 90s. Younger person, it's still a tragedy. You know, younger people get scammed by the IRS scam, where the government calls and says, you know, we're going to send police to your house unless you pay. Older people in general have paid enough taxes and filed enough tax returns to often know that the IRS never calls you. They do not call you. Younger person, 21 years old, you know, maybe dad or mom filed their tax returns and not quite. So you do have that issue. But they're doing some very interesting research. I talked to a scientist in Florida with a team that's looking at ways that they can maybe, you know, with your permission, they give you protection software that is allowed to comb through your email and gives you a better, like a super duper spam detector on steroids, mm-hmm. that might flag stuff for you or make things that look suspicious much larger type for you to check out.
Interesting.
That kind of stuff. And I think it's an interesting approach. But check this out. I mean, there is a technology piece of this, just as you raised, but I'll tell you the story. You know, we did for the series find lots of people around the country who had lost money in different ways. One guy was just an older gentleman in, I think it was Naples, Florida. It'll come back to me exactly where in Florida. But he's taking a stroll, minding his business with his cane. His son told me the story. Bumps into a nice woman who appears to be in her 30s. Really, there seems to be chemistry. This guy in his 90s and this woman in her 30s. And she starts getting him to sign over all the money. And the son is a law professor, and the daughter is a former prosecutor. And they have one heck of a time trying to persuade him that this is not on the up and up. They even get a detective who takes an interest in the case. He finds out that she was a known scammer. He still didn't want to hear about it. Something rare did happen. The kids got prosecutors to go after the woman. She loses in court, and she has to give back what she can. He gets half his money back. But here's the sad part. I mean, well, here's the sad part. The whole story's been sad. Here's another sad part. He does get half his money back, about 50 grand, but then he dies 3 or 4 months later. His kids think maybe it was the strain of this whole thing.
It's just interesting because the advent of the internet has brought so much information together. And I think that your example about the IRS, it almost fits the reverse of the older folks with technology. They had a lack of familiarity, and the younger folks have that same lack of familiarity with taxes. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side of that, you know, there are, you know, as with anything now, you know, you could be into left-handed butterflies and find a meetup group and a chat room and experts who spent their life studying that. And I think that you know, that connectivity has brought in people who can become expert scammers, you know, kind of at scale, and also give them access at scale to potential victims. And so we see a proliferation of, you know, a greater number of scammers. You almost have it in some senses advertised to them, you know, people that are sort of floating around that part of the web looking for easy ways to make money. All of a sudden they, you know, it's just not unlikely they come upon 10 easy steps to scam somebody out of $100,000, and why not give it a shot? You know, part of it also, I think, would tie into circumstantial, sort of like the logistics of just bringing people together. And then that maybe reveals, you know, I just wonder what you think is how significant the brain piece of it is, you know, versus the circumstance piece of it, or the, you know, evolution of society piece of it, and where the two sort of end up meeting.
I think it all fits together. I think what's particularly interesting about the brain piece of it is, what if they can ultimately someday, it's not now, what if they can give you a scam and go, hey, here's your vulnerability quotient? And this is controversial, but what if that means if you're particularly a little bit more vulnerable than someone else, that an investment professional has to deal with you differently, like can't sell you something so risky without some kind of other education or something like that. But it all completely fits together. I mean, what's so confounding is I talked to these gerontologists, these doctors who treat older people, and the patients present as like absolutely the last person in the world you think would get scammed. I met this amazing woman in the state of New Jersey, and she is a nurse, even in her late 70s, and she's a fill-in school nurse, and she just, you know, drives herself around. She drives better than I do. She's really funny. She reads as like she's 62, and she had gotten the phone call. Joe, you would have known to be careful. She wasn't saying, hey, we noticed some viruses on your computer. You want to sign up for a service? We'll make sure you don't have viruses on your computer. She gives them a credit card, and they call her back, it appears. I tried to piece this together, and this is what it looks like what happened. They call her back months later. She doesn't get any service. She pays them like $400. She doesn't get any service, but they took her money. They call her back and they go, hey, that company you gave the $400 to went out of business. We would like to give you a refund. What's your bank account number? So she gives them some information, it appears. And they direct her attention online and they show her, at least they create the illusion, or maybe they really did it. Can't quite tell. They drain the account of $30,000 for just a little while. She freaks out, this amazing woman. She just freaks out. And they say, if you want your money back, do as I say. And this is the part that's a little hard to swallow, but she's not the only one this has ever happened to. Over the course of 2 weeks, they tell her to keep going to Walmart and Target to get gift cards and turn the codes over to the guy on the phone. And she keeps doing it. First, she does it because she thinks she's going to get her money back from her account. Then she does it because they're threatening her. And I went through all the receipts. It took me forever. She bought $166,000 in gift cards.
Wow.
$166,000. And, you know, you wouldn't guess. She's just like, you know, totally together. But they figured out a way to kind of prey on her concerns. And when you have an emotional reaction to something, like, hey, your bank account with $30,000 in it is zero, you don't often react to it rationally. Right. And it's that thing that when they call and they say, hey, it's your nephew, you know, he's in a Mexican jail, or your nephew's been in a car crash, send money. You get an emotional reaction and you stop asking the critical thinking questions. And all of us could fall victim to that. But what the doctors are worried about is it may be some people that you wouldn't suspect are vulnerable or actually are. And got to keep an eye on them.
Yeah, and again, that points back to how formulaic that could be, all those pressure points and refining them. And I think there, you know, some people are even doing A-B testing on which little facets of, of the story work best, you know.
They got schools overseas that teach the scam stuff, according to the federal government. So that's probably exactly what they do. I bet you're right.
And so, you know, it's sort of separate, but just since you're in the world, you know, how much justice, obviously with Bitcoin and the money disappearing into other countries, things don't often end well. Are you getting any sense that authorities are able to start finding ways to get to the people that are doing this, or are they largely pretty safe?
Well, I mean, if it's international organized crime doing it, which often it is, it's pretty effective. And the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission and others have been going after some. They have these sweeps in which they arrest a lot of people. In one of the sweeps a couple years ago, they didn't just go for the overseas scammer. They're looking for the supply chain of scam. For instance, if there was a fake investment solicitation, who wrote it? And so they found apparently the writer in the United States somewhere who would write the stuff. Who printed it? They find the printer out in Nevada who printed it. And that helps shut some of it down. And they don't get many. Most of the stuff gets out. The best thing that they find is to sensitize people to the types of scams that are out there. Once people learned about that tech support scam, over the last couple of years, they've tracked victims of tech support, you know, it's a fake tech support. The number of incidents has gone down because, you know, you and I talk about it. Hey, they call saying they're going to, you know, rid your computer of viruses. Be careful of that. Then people are inured to it. They did catch this guy, but it's a special case. I got to tell you about this. I'm laughing instead of crying because it's so awful. This guy calls this older gentleman. I think he's in his late 80s, early 90s, and it's a scam. And he figures out it's a scam right away, but he keeps him on the line. And eventually the scammer starts realizing after several phone calls that he's being strung along, and he starts making these crazy threats, really blood-curdling threats, which the guy recorded. It took him a couple years, but they nabbed him on his way in from Jamaica to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York. They got the scammer. He got convicted. But here's the thing. The guy he tried to scam is the former head of the FBI and the same guy as the former head of the CIA, William Webster. And so, yeah, if you're William Webster, yeah, they get the guy. But they did. They figured it out, and they waited for him to come in the country, and they got him. You know, maybe there'll be some deterrence there. And then the other thing which I mentioned, I'll just come back to, a lot of the scams are being done by family members, you know, people who feel entitled. They're like, hey, we took care of you. We get to have your money. Or maybe we didn't take care of you. We feel we get to have your money. And a lot of the financial exploitation, these experts are telling me, are happening from people well known to the victim. And, you know, those are heartbreaking cases.
Sort of a weird parallel, but I'm just curious to get your take on it just because, again, you have an interesting, you know, a big purview that a lot of us don't. You know, there's a strange mentality that has emerged from the coronavirus. I mean, I guess not strange, but the fervor around it. And that's, you know, hoarding, buying, you know, 10,000 gallons of Purell or whatever, hand sanitizer. And you literally can't find it anywhere now. And people are trying to sell it for $100. And to me, it sort of taps into some kind of underlying energy. And it's maybe an unsureness, maybe a, again, I don't want to get too far out there, but the buzz of just how quick things move. And, you know, I feel like when I talk to people that are older and they talk about the world, there's just a slight bit of overwhelm. And that expresses itself in different ways, which, you know, could be that these scammers become sort of a path of least resistance, almost like, you know, a volcano where some of that anxiousness can erupt through and, you know, to bad results here and people hoarding the things to try to protect themselves against more of the, you know, emotional than technical threat. Do you see any parallel to that?
Well, I mean, it is interesting about the coronavirus stuff and the hoarding. I mean, economists study this and they can predict that people will want to hoard. And way before coronavirus, there have been our friends, the preppers, you know, they're ready for anything. And, you know, you've all felt the instinct, right? Like if a storm is coming and you're in Florida, you know, you just like, there is something that kicks in and you want to have enough stuff on hand to get you through. Maybe that's something that's deep in our psyche. But you try to control it because you try to be a good public citizen and not buy stuff that you're not going to need so that other people who don't have any end up the short end of the stick. But yeah, there is a feeling of vulnerability that people have. And, you know, the virus certainly is a very direct, real issue that is adding to that vulnerability. And the way that one of the tools that the scammers use, I've been told, that fits into exactly what you asked, is you have older folks who feel they want to leave something. They want to leave some wealth to their family that they love. And maybe they haven't accumulated that much or that they've been using some of it up because they're in their retirement. You're supposed to use up what you've saved. And they want to leave something because they feel that they don't want their kids to be financially vulnerable. So a scammer comes along peddling some get-rich-quick thing. And they're like, yeah, I'll do that. That'll give money for my kids or my nephew who needs it. And it plays on this economic insecurity that so many of us feel in America.
So it sounds like there are a few different categories. So there are the people who sort of hide in the utility, you've got a virus, we need to fix that, you need to give us access to that. There are the people who are, you know, using the timeless technique of whatever the 30-year-old woman with the 90-year-old guy was doing. And then there are the people being tempted in knowingly walking into it with sort of a greed mindset. Do you think that those differences reflect differently in the brain, or do you think they all kind of fall back to the same sort of tendency?
No, I think there's different vulnerabilities in many different people. And as I say, there are plenty of older people who are completely scam resistant and they just don't have it. But I think what the scientists are worried about is people we thought were in the category of scam resistant may not be, because there's no other problem other than this weird vulnerability that some people have. And again, younger people are also scammed. So here's an important distinction. What the scientists say is, if you've throughout your life been vulnerable to scams, that doesn't fit the category. You're just a person who's gullible, right? And so you've been gullible since you were 21. And that doesn't mean your brain changed and you became gullible. They're particularly interested in a new pattern of behavior where you become more vulnerable to this, possibly because of some of this process of aging. But sometimes, you know, someone has been a risk taker their whole life, you know, willing to throw the dice at Vegas or with their investments. And, you know, if they throw the dice and lose when they're 78 years old, you know, that's just who they are. And, you know, the scientists would like to protect them, but that's a different animal altogether.
So this topic has captivated you enough, interested you enough that you've done multiple pieces of content on it. You're going to be giving talks about it. And we're having, obviously, this conversation about it. So where do you see yourself taking it next? You know, are you drawn to do any different or bigger things? Or, you know, where does this play in the context of the next year for you?
Well, I'm on the air across the country 5 times a day, and then we got podcasts and stuff. And, you know, on a week that you and I are talking, we've got craziness in the markets. We got the coronavirus story that's completely changing the economy. So I'm covering that day to day. But what I like to do is, in addition to the daily stuff, which I think is crucial, I want stuff that, you know, 6 months from now, people say, oh yeah, do you remember that guy or that show did this kind of journalism? So I try to pick special projects as we go along. And one of the ongoing things that may interest you that I've done quite a bit of work in is something I affectionately call Robots Ate My Job. This is about technological unemployment. This is about, as the workforce gets much more full of technology and algorithms take over a lot of stuff, where does it leave human beings? And, well, economists since time immemorial have always said, yeah, technology is disruptive. Yeah, lots of people lose their jobs, but people get more jobs in the end that are better. And that's just how it's always worked out. Like 98% of agricultural jobs in America were destroyed by, you know, farming equipment. You know, just they lost those jobs. People then got jobs in factories, or their kids got jobs in factories that were more productive and they got paid more and they were less backbreaking. Yeah. Well, some experts who are not fringe characters, these are legit sources and not just one, are worried that this time is different, that technology is moving much faster than it used to. It's not our imagination. And it doesn't take the singularity for there to be, you know, machines that are self-aware. It doesn't take that to throw a lot of people out of work. And there's nobody who says it's not going to be disruptive. It could be more disruptive than the last financial crisis. And that leads to a political issue, which is if people are feeling like really vulnerable, they vote in certain ways and you have political reaction. So I'm really interested in that stuff. I did a cross-country journey one time in a car. It wasn't quite robotic. I did it a couple years ago before we really could get a robot car to do it. But I tried to drive from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, just me, and never interact with a human being over 6 days. Because, you know, you pay for gas by swiping, you do self-checkout at the grocery, that kind of stuff. Almost made it.
Someone tried to squeegee your window.
Yeah, pretty much. It was like one of those things. No, at the self-checkout in Roanoke, Virginia, you know, I had the microwave in the back of the car that I was going to bring to a hotel chain that used to have robot check-in devices. You never saw a person. You just swipe and the key would spit out. Anyway, I'm going to get my food. And you know how you can't scan certain things? Well, the maven of the checkout counter is like trying to help me. I'm running away. That's all on film, by the way, too. But then one other mistake. I mean, I used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I knew better than this. I planned this journey myself. I didn't like have a producer on this. And I had my Easy Pass from back east for the tolls. And I get to San Francisco, and the last bridge I got to cross is the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, because I got to get to the Pacific in San Francisco. They don't take Easy Pass. So I'm like, no. You know what I did? It's possible. I don't want to admit this in this format, but it is possible I may have run the toll.
Oh, yeah. You have to. It's for your work.
Yeah, I mean, come on. So someone said that's cheating. That's sort of like you stealing your food and saying you didn't. And I said, look, fair enough. But America is that way now. There's a lot of machines around us, and any kind of job where there's repetition even a job that you thought you had to have a big graduate education in, like pathology, you know, reading cells in the medical field, there's algorithms that are learning how to do this. And so we have to have a national conversation about training people for the good jobs, or a national conversation about how we're going to, you know, compensate people so that people can live well when the machines are doing all this stuff. So yeah, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah, and then of course, you mentioned, just touched there briefly on universal basic income.
Oh, you got it right there.
And I think the interesting thing about that is the framework, right? Because the more wide open futurists say, who said that we were supposed to work, right? I mean, if we're constantly building these things and doing these things, isn't the end of that road where we do just get to sit back and enjoy things? And, you know, you almost say that, you know, we had this ethic, work ethic, and, you know, contribute and toe your own. And I think for, you know, there's a large part of the population that would probably just be happy, you know, getting all the free time in the world and their basic needs met. And then there's the innovators and the, you know, the capitalists or whatever who want to go crazy and make all the money. Then there certainly is a world where both of those can exist and, you know, work with each other. But so what's your general vibe now with the reality of universal basic income as a solution to that?
I mean, I've always been really interested in it. People bring it up a lot, and it includes some people like Elon Musk and others push it. They're researching this, and, you know, Alaska already has one. You know, there was that oil income that if you just were a citizen of Alaska, you got a check in the mail each year. And they were trying to figure out if it makes you lazy or if it, you know, what does it do? And they find it does not make you lazy. But if there were something like universal basic income, if that were deemed to be something that's useful, there needs to be a change in thinking. I mean, it sounds like you're a man, Joe, who could take the leisure time and be productive. I think there's a lot of people who have no idea how to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd play video games until they, you know, wasted away. Or we need to learn how to find meaning in not necessarily work, if this is where this is going. And we're not that good at it. Anyone who was working and then loses their job, even if they have some savings, it hurts your self-esteem. There's all that stuff. So we have to, like, figure out what is it we're doing with our time. Are we doing volunteer work? Are we, you know, helping people through education? Are we doing artistic stuff? You know, this is all good stuff. You know, economists say this discussion is a little ahead of really where this is going. But people who walk around smugly thinking, well, I have a graduate education, robots ain't going to take my job,
right?
They got something coming. Because look, if you kick in Siri or Bixby or any of those other digital voice assistants and say, tell me the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it spits it right back out. Well, that's not my whole job, but it's a little piece of my job. And they got robots that write, you know, boring news stories, but they write news stories. So, you know, this stuff is coming, and we are terrible at training people in America, retraining, you know, saying, look, you got to make a turn in your career. We just don't want to pay for it, and we think it's a waste. And the thing is, we got to change that because, you know, many of us may have several careers across our lifetime as the technology, you know, gets rid of one thing and gives us some other opportunity.
It's a fabric change. So it's going to take a generation or two to shake out and educate in a different way that, you know, the work ethic thing, so that you don't get depressed when you lose your job. I mean, that's all a framework thing and certainly could be overcome, I think, in a couple of generations. So we'd probably lose Nintendo stock, would go up or whatever the video game is, for a couple of generations as people did that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, educators who are reflective say that we are educating, you know, if you're teaching first, second, and third grade, we're educating kids for jobs that don't even exist yet, you know? So this is a whole interesting, fertile field for inquiry, but it is going to be disruptive. And we talk about globalization, oh, you know, trade is killing our jobs. The robots are also creating some havoc. And, you know, I'm hoping that there'll be more of a discussion of this, you know, if not in this campaign, then soon, because it could be managed, you know, in your part of the world. It would be nice if people were being educated for those jobs of the future instead of, you know, them going somewhere else. Reno, Sparks, Nevada, you think of it as the desert or gambling or something like that. They have a really thriving Silicon Valley-like tech culture right now. It's not huge, but it's working. And they got lucky, but they also had some good leadership, and they've got a lot of employment over there. And that's because some policymakers have been on the ball about this stuff. And there are other areas that could have been Reno Sparks that are really lagging. And I've seen the, like, lists of regions where there's going to be these winners and losers predicted, and it just shows you. You know, we all got a big stake in focusing on this.
If I were going to put my futurist hat on, I would say that one little clawback we'll get is I think we're going to see a trend in local rising. I think that you know, the information flow, you know, the Cambridge Analytica kind of stuff, and just, you know, the overwhelm, a lot of it tying back into the scamming. It's just, I think that, you know, there was a wisdom to being able to know everybody in your circle to some extent. And, you know, there's a lot of, I'm sure you've read the scientific, whatever, this is a limit that people can really know is 200 some people, whatever it is, that is where tribes that have historically carved off and become new tribes, you know, as they've grown to certain numbers. And I think that when you do that, and then you sort of, you overlay the environmental movement and the decrease in, you know, until different transportation comes around, but packaging decrease in wanting to carry things across the world, that you're going to get into, you know, resurgence of local production, local farming, and all of that, and which will, you know, counteract some of the big mega farms and those things that can be run by machine. So I think that might be a little hedge going forward.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I hate to brag, but in 2012, I did a documentary film. It's called Fixing the Future. It had different chapters of ways to rethink the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it had a theme throughout it of the power of local, you know, and, you know, it may not make sense for you to produce your own penicillin in your town, but there is a lot that you could do. And as part of that, I was up in Washington State, Bellingham, Washington. A guy who makes these super high-end pizza ovens for places like California Pizza Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have saved a lot of money and made a lot more profit by outsourcing the production to, say, Asia at the time. And he says, you know, I live locally. Local's important to me. I want this community to be good and have jobs. And so he went, wait, I could buy some technology, robots, and I could hire people and train them locally here to run them. And he actually created local jobs that fed the local community.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. And the business was growing when last I checked with him. And, you know, he's driving a Volvo. I go, dude, you could have made more profit if you'd gone to Asia. And he goes, how much do I really need? I'm doing all right. And my community is part of the compensation. There's so many angles to the local stuff. And some people are even talking about, you know, you take a look at your investment portfolio. Why does it have to be intergalactic in scope? Why can't you reward, you know, if you're putting some money somewhere, why can't some of it be local? The state of North Dakota has a kind of Fed, Federal Reserve, for itself. It's the Bank of North Dakota. It's a state-sponsored bank. And, you know, it's just like a bank, but when it lends according to certain rules that the political system has decided that are good for North Dakota. So, yeah, it's going to lend a little bit more to farmers. It's going to lend a little bit more to local businesses or things that create jobs or help education instead of like, hey, let's just, you know, send the money to Wall Street and it'll land wherever it may. So, yeah, I mean, local, I think, is a really interesting idea.
So the Catalyst, which is the news platform that this goes out under, we're sort of experimenting with different ways to reconfigure local news. We're bringing in elements of social. We're doing community source content. We've actually gone out to a lot of our leaders, the mayor, the city council, different nonprofits, other thought leaders, and said, will you commit to put content on our platform kind of under these guidelines that we want to be insightful, acumen building, not just standard sort of puff pieces or whatever. And then we started to have good conversations. And as we sort of studied, you know, what took attention away from local news to social media, I call it idea stacking, which is essentially a deeper, more rewarding way to interact with content. The idea goes out there. People are liking it. People are commenting on it. People are adding their ideas and stacking on top of the original ideas. And you get this much more rewarding sort of interaction with content, which is why it became, you know, a lot more attractive than just, you know, the newspaper per se. And so we sort of tried to bring some of those elements into our news environment. And, you know, one little secret sauce that we do is that we moderate our comments, because another thing we found is that, you know, you can start to have a good conversation on big social, I call it, which is a, you know, Professor Galloway sort of mindset, but then they often get hijacked, as we all know.
Yeah, sad but true.
So we're, you know, we're moderating and, you know, not letting anything to go up that would close the mind to conversations. So we're actually even thinking about doing a funny sort of a sarcastic, you know, rating system where it's either good idea or Twitter. So you can send them to Twitter if they're not. But so, you know, I'd love to get your take on some of the trends in news. You know, you're mixing podcasts, you're mixing media. You know, where do you see local news specifically going and what's going to be working in the coming years?
I don't have a good answer to that. And I think a lot about it. I just spent 3 days at a conference in the state of Maine where we chewed on that for 3 days. Without strong news and strong local news, democracy has got a deep problem. And as you know, the old economic model that newspapers had, you know, had its vulnerabilities, but it also had its charm. They sold classified ads and they sold a lot of regular ads. And often they were the only game in town. And they had therefore enough money to put a warm human body into all these different city council chambers and mayor's offices. And the broadcasters have a harder time doing that. We don't have that kind of economic model to have all those warm bodies.
Right.
So it is a huge challenge. So I like what I'm hearing from you, which is these media organizations that say they're interactive, but you know, they're getting a few tweets and then ignoring them. That's not interactivity. The idea of this kind of tiered system stacking in which you're building a conversation based on, and you know, if you're building a conversation based on the audience input, it is in part your own audience giving you a very strong indication of what they're interested in and what they find the most compelling about the conversation. That's really, you know, interesting to me. There are communities where just mayhem goes on politically, rank corruption, and you just don't know about it because there's no local media.
Right.
How about this? At the conference that I came back from a couple of weeks ago, an academic shared a statistic. I'll try to conjure it for you. I have it right in front of me. But they're able to find equivalent towns. One has a decent local newspaper, one doesn't, and these pairs of towns are equivalent in size and something. The town that doesn't have the local newspaper, the interest rate they pay on their municipal bonds is higher. And the supposition is that investors think it's riskier because of the possibility that the place without the media is more corrupt and that the politicians are more likely to be on the take because there's no media holding their feet to the fire.
Sure.
And I was like, that's fascinating. You're like paying through the nose for not having a newspaper. But how do you fund it? I don't know. I mean, like one of the fun ideas I once saw, but I can also see the problems, is there's a media scholar named Robert McChesney, and I think it was his idea and some collaborator. You know how you check off on your tax return $3 to fund public campaigns? You know, we'll give $3, not of your tax money, but of the, you know, treasury.
Right.
So that they don't have to be, you know, taking money from special interests or something. In my home state of Maine, they have fully publicly funded elections for the state house, and I think they still have that. But anyway, the idea was, okay, you can check off for campaigns. Why not check off for accredited media? So I give $5 a year on my tax return. It's a big bundle of money that goes to this really large list of media organizations. And, you know, some of those media organizations you, Joe, would object to. They're not your idea of a good time. But there would be some things that you were. And you then specify where you'd like that percentage of that pot to be funneled over toward. So, like, you know, you might say it wouldn't be gardening monthly. It would be news. But maybe there could be this kind of subsidy. Because it could generate a lot of money for local media. The objection to it is, who decides who is accredited,
yep,
right? So if you have a politician in power that, you know, doesn't like certain, you know, because they don't like what the media is covering, suddenly they get unaccredited. That happened at the White House press corps. So that's the issue. But I like the creativity and approach. I mean, it gets people thinking.
Sure.
The Brits charge you just to have a TV. You know, there's the license fee for the BBC.
Yep.
And they used to bust you if you didn't. They detected you had a TV and you hadn't paid the license. That ain't going to fly in America. But, you know, in Florida, you have some of the great examples of this, of newspapers that are profit-seeking, but not necessarily their investors don't require big profits. I think, isn't there a St. Petersburg paper, I think, might have been one of those. I'm not sure.
Yeah, the Tampa Bay Times was owned by a nonprofit, the Poynter Institute. Just Nelson Poynter founded the Times and then founded the Institute. And the Institute, you know, they have PolitiFact and a few other things. And they are the owners of the Times.
Well, there you go. So like, it was down there. So, I mean, those are all interesting, but I don't have an easy solution. And I'm extremely, like you, worried about it. You know, public radio does its part, but it's like, really? Minnesota Public Radio, which is connected to the outfit that owns my show, Marketplace, they have partnered with the Minneapolis newspaper, and they have more people, you know, covering politics in different jurisdictions than other places. But, you know, we really miss that classified ad revenue, you know, when you want to sell a trailer hitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I sat next to Craig one time, and he admits it. I think he's actually funded some media projects because he's aware of the issue. And Craigslist didn't even make him money. That's the irony of it. It's not one of those things. So it's not that money just shifts. Sometimes money just gets burned.
Well, I've appreciated your time. I know you're very busy, and we're excited to have you down in our neck of the woods. We'll get the links to the show and recommend anybody who is available to drop in and hear what you have to say, because you've obviously been in the thick of it and have some great ideas. So thanks for sharing them with us.
Okay. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for the interest.